From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today is pianist Marian McPartland's 80th birthday. She celebrates with a concert from New York's Town Hall that will be broadcast live tomorrow night. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with McPartland. Also, the American Dream, as described by early Hollywood movies, was mostly created in studios run by Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, like Warner, Zucker, Mayer, and Goldwyn. A new documentary about them will be shown Sunday on A&E. We'll hear from Neil Gabler, who wrote the book it's based on. And film critic John Powers reviews Primary Colors. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is pianist Marian McPartland's 80th birthday. She's celebrating with a concert at New York's Town Hall tomorrow night that will be broadcast live on many NPR stations. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with McPartland, recorded in 1987. She's not only a great pianist, she's brought us interviews with and performances by great pianists in her NPR series, Marian McPartland's Piano Jazz, which has been running nearly 20 years. Let's hear a brief excerpt of her show with Bill Evans.
I guess probably because I meet so many young pianists, I haven't the faintest idea how to get from one key to another. Oh. Now, see, from F to A flat isn't bad, but suppose you were going to go from, say you had to go from F to B, how would you go?
Well, I don't know, but you know, we used to have to do that, right? I mean, on jobs, you know, you just the guy.
Did you ever play club dates?
Did I
weddings?
Ever play?
Well, I don't
kidding.
Know. Did you?
You got to be kidding. Of course.
Mitzvahs, did you?
For how many years?
I honestly didn't know you did, because I did. I played a lot of them. Actually, I had some pretty good people there. Roy Eldridge used to play these things.
Well,
with
you're
me.
Lucky. I mean, I played with, you know, I was just saying the other day that something took me back. We started playing a polka during the record date, just kidding around. Toots got into a polka. I said it took me back to the Manville Polish home where I used to play with a great polka band, man. The leader was a drummer who sat on a riser so high that it looked like you were looking straight up at him when you were in the bandstand. And he played with one hand and held a microphone in the other and say he knew thousands of polkas in Polish. But I mean, there's just one example. I used to go there, used to have to take a train, go to Manville, play the job for 4 hours. You used to play 2 hours, get a half hour break, and play an hour and a half. And I think I made $4 or maybe $5. Of course, this was in the 40s. But I played all the jobs and the weddings. And then when I came to New York, even when I had started to record already, had won the new jazz critics poll, you know, new talent, mm-hmm. whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
all
that,
of that,
sure.
I still had my tuxedo. You know, regularly cleaned and pressed,
yeah.
And was playing a friendship club in Brooklyn 3 nights a week in Roseland and all of the kind of, you know, society gigs.
Let's do another tune.
Yeah, okay.
How about a thing you were noodling with before?
The ballad?
This is all I ask.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
Who wrote that? I'm trying to think.
Gordon Jenkins. Yeah, I just recorded it last week with for my next Warner's album with Toots Thielemans.
This is all I ask.
This is all I ask.
Marian McPartland with Bill Evans from a 1979 edition of her piano jazz series. McPartland is one of the few women instrumentalists of her generation who made it in the world of jazz. She grew up in England and moved to America after marrying Chicago cornetist Jimmy McPartland. They met during World War II while they were each performing for the troops. For the first few years of her 20-year marriage, she played Dixieland standards with her husband, but since the early 50s, she's led her own small groups, playing more modern music. Jimmy McPartland died in March of 1991, a month after he and Marion remarried. Here's our 1987 interview with Marion McPartland.
I'd like to talk with you about your life. So many of your listeners on radio have heard you talk with other musicians about their lives. I want to hear some about yours. I know you came from a pretty proper family in England. Your mother played classical music and I think wished that you played classical music too. They didn't like the idea of you playing jazz. What did it represent to your parents?
I don't think they minded. I don't think they minded what I played. It was just when they got the idea that I was going to do something in music that they weren't going to see me get what they thought would be a nice job. Like my father always thought it would be nice if I worked in a bank or became a nurse, of all ridiculous things. And they really didn't mind me playing jazz, but when they finally got the word that I was going to be in it, then it was became a different thing, became music as a profession.
What did they object to about that?
Oh, just the idea of, I think my mother said, what was it? Oh, you'll come to no good. You'll marry a musician and live in an attic. See, that's pretty much what happened. Although we weren't ever in the attic, but we were in some funny little apartments. But that was her idea, that I would meet terrible people and that I would come to no good, you know, that it would represent it something depraved.
Did your teachers in music school feel the same way?
When I finally studied the 3 years that I did take lessons at the Guildhall School of Music, I played by ear up until that time. When I was studying, the professor I had there was a very wonderful guy, very solemn, but very much against jazz. And at that time, I was really into learning all kinds of jazz from records. And I would be supposed to be practicing, but I would be playing something by Art Tatum or trying to perfect an Art Tatum run or something. And he opened the door one time and said, got very red in the face, "Stop playing that trash!" I'm afraid there's probably still a few people that feel that way, but not as much as they did at that time. But it really wasn't long after that that I left and took off with a four-piano act. That was my first introduction to not so much the jazz life, but the show business life. And actually, now I'm rather proud of having worked in all those vaudeville theaters because they're very historical places, those of them that are still standing.
Probably gave you some stage confidence also.
Well, yes, and how to act and talk on a microphone, although doing the piano show helped a lot more.
I think your entry into the jazz life came during World War II when you were playing for the troops and playing a lot of jazz. Were you considered something of a freak being a woman jazz musician?
No, I don't think so, Terry. Because when I went to France and played in a group for the armed forces, that really wasn't jazz. That was sort of showbiz again. And then, actually, after I met Jimmy, I guess that's when I feel that I really got into playing a little more actual jazz. But then, when I came here to the States and got to hear all the people in person that I had loved for so long on records, like Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Teddy Wilson, all those people, then a lot of it did start to sort of rub off on me, and I became a better player because of hearing all these people, and of course because of Jimmy working with his group.
Well, when you started playing, you were playing with your husband's band.
Yes.
And I wonder if it was hard for you to get your own sense of identity as a performer. I think a lot of women who are married to someone who they work with, especially a few decades ago, were considered the wife of and kind of secondary to the man who was performing. Did that ever happen?
It's funny. I guess I must have been naturally pushy or something. Plus, plus the fact that Jimmy was very helpful. He was always very helpful and very admiring of my talent. And he was always kind of introducing me to do solo numbers and to do numbers with the band. He seemed to be very proud of what I did. In fact, when we moved to New York, it was really through Jimmy that I got started with the trio, because I really didn't want to. He kept saying, "Oh, you ought to have your own trio, and you shouldn't be working in this band." I could feel myself getting out of the Dixieland chord structure and into more modern things. And of course, I listened to everything that was going on all the time. So he really was the one that kind of sold me on the idea that I should have my own trio. And once I did start with the trio, Jimmy was very helpful in introducing me to all kinds of people. And I always tell him he created a monster because, you know, once I started, I didn't want to stop. That was it.
Well, some jazz musicians remain sidemen all their lives. They spend their lives playing with other people's bands.
That's true.
Very early on in your career, you became a leader. How did you manage to pull that off?
Well, working with Jimmy is sort of, I mean, working with your own husband, I mean, it in many ways, it was a very comfortable situation. And starting with the trio, I guess what happened was that I got booked in this one place, the Embers, and so since I had been booked as the leader, I was able to hire the people to work with me, and from then on it always was that way. I was always booked and as the leader, and would hire the best. I always wanted the best sidemen there were available. As a matter of fact, in a way, I'm kind of sorry that I didn't, what I would call, go through the ranks and be a side man or side person with some other groups. But it just didn't work out that way, because I went right from working with Jimmy to my own trio. And it was very hard because it was a top club, and I felt that I was very green and callow. And it's funny, I couldn't open my mouth. I remember we had my group, and Eddie Haywood was opposite me, and I couldn't even think what to say to introduce him. I had it written on a piece of paper. "Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And now I'd like to introduce Eddie Haywood." And, you know, I would do it, and I would be shaking. It was so funny. But, you know, we went. I guess you learn by doing, you know.
Jimmy McPartland used to drink a lot.
Yes, he sure did.
Did you ever feel, since you were his wife, when you were playing together on the bandstand, that you had to keep one eye on how much he was drinking?
Oh, Terry, that's a whole other... I mean, if you ever want to do a show on alcoholism and AA, I could talk about that. I mean, Jimmy finally went into AA, and I was probably a terrible person because I was always nagging and worrying about that. It just seems like there's always somebody around, a person who drinks a lot. There's always some sort of well-meaning do-gooder trying to keep them straight, and that was me.
Well, that must have put a real strain on your performing, to on the one hand be playing, and on the other hand trying to keep track of what was happening with your husband.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many anecdotes I could tell about that. At this point, they seem funny, though at the time they weren't, because, you know, when somebody's drinking, they always have a million friends who want to make sure that they buy them drinks and they get their quota. You know, Jimmy would walk around the bar and tell everybody that his wife couldn't stand to see him drink, and so his friends would say, "Oh, that's terrible." You know, they would carry a water glass full of gin into the men's room, and I never could figure out how he got... Although Jimmy wasn't a sort of a falling down drunk, he just got very slow and boring, you know. And the worst thing that would happen would be he'd be announcing a tune, and it would take him 10 minutes to announce the tune, and we'd all be saying, "Oh, for God's sake, get on with it," you know. No, that's a whole other side of my life, and it seems to have, in retrospect, as I say, a lot of it seems very funny, though at the time it was quite a tragedy, but it's great. It worked out because he did stop, and he has a very healthy life. He's a very healthy person, and so many of the musicians that he worked with are gone, probably because of that. You know, a lot of people died too young.
We're featuring a 1987 interview with pianist Marion McPartland. Jimmy McPartland died 4 years after our conversation was recorded. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Back with more of our 1987 interview with pianist Marion McPartland. Today's her 80th birthday.
You told us a little earlier that you didn't feel that out of place being a woman early on in your jazz career, and I'll tell you, I find that hard to believe.
Well, you see, Terry, before I had gone to America, there were so many women that I had listened to who were my idols, like Hazel Scott, Mary Lou Williams, Lil Armstrong, and a woman who I really admired a great deal, Cleo Brown. So that I didn't realize that being a woman, when I got to New York, being a woman with a jazz group, people would find it unusual, because it seemed to me that there were plenty of women out there, and I still think so.
You know what might have been helpful to you, too, being married to a jazz musician? And what I mean by that is that you weren't, quote, available to any man who thinks, well, I think I'll flirt with that dame pianist, you know, because
I'm sure... that's true. That's true. You know, and then there's this to it also, Terry, that when I did get out with my own trio, I was really in it for the music. Like, although I think I dressed pretty well, you know, cared about my appearance, there wasn't any idea of, well, I'm going to play and I'm going to be winking at some guy at the bar. I wanted so much for the music to be accepted, and I really wanted to play as well as I could, and that's always been in the forefront, you know, to try to play as well as I could. Although at that time I think I was rather dependent upon the opinion of other people. I mean, I'm not so much that anymore. I've sort of become my own person a little more than I was then.
You know, women singers have always been accepted more than women instrumentalists.
Oh, definitely. That's a whole other breed, yeah, singers. I don't know why that is. Well, because every band had the girl singer. And, you know, that's a whole other story. I don't even want to get into that. I would hate to have been a girl singer, because I feel that you're really fair game then when you're traveling on with a busload of guys. And that must have been awfully hard.
And you had to dress more sexy, too.
Oh, sure.
Low-cut gowns and things like that when you were the, quote, girl singer. You've, as a musician, had to be on the road a lot during your life. You've been lucky enough to have very long stays at certain clubs, like the Cafe Carlyle in New York and the Hickory House in New York. But I think life on the road is the downfall of a lot of performers, and it's in part how they end up on drugs or alcohol. Was it hard to not give in to temptations like that, especially probably with some of the, not peer pressure exactly, but when you're hanging out with people and everybody's going drinking after the set, you know?
Oh, I had my share of drinks, but I always had that feeling about, like, years ago when we used to be hanging out in pubs in England, it was always that, you know, you're supposed to be able to drink and hold it. You're not supposed to get drunk. You know, it's sort of undignified and terrible, undignified thing to do. So I could never, ever see myself getting out of control. I mean, I used to like to have drinks at the Hickory House. In fact, I used to like to pour a straight shot when nobody was looking. I thought I was really getting back at the owner. I would get one of the bottles. You know, we were surrounded by bottles on the bandstand, and when nobody was looking, I would pour myself a shot and drink it, you know, and sort of one up for me. But as far as pot or any of the other things, I wouldn't do that to myself. I mean, I did smoke a little pot, but just once or twice, but it never affected me in a good way. And a bass player once said to me, "Oh, but Marion, you really have to learn how to handle that. You have to get used to being able to handle it." I said, "Well, if I have to do that, then I don't want to do it." And I've never done anything that would get in the way of playing, although I can see how that would be a hang-up for some people, because I think one has that feeling of wanting to be on top and be the best you can possibly be every night, and that if you take something that's going to help you be that way, temptation is to be wanting to do that every night.
You know, your career has had an interesting graph to it. A lot of musicians start their careers well, early on in their lives, become very well known for a certain style, for a certain recording, and then they reach a peak early on, and it's kind of in the public eye, it's kind of downhill from there. And I think with your career, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been this slow upward.
It's amazing. Isn't it?
Every year you become better known, and I think your playing becomes more beautiful. And I think it's an unusual twist on the typical career.
It's funny. I just feel as if everything I've done has been a sort of a springboard to do something else, and I like to set goals for myself and always have something new to do. And I also have this feeling that one, you're supposed to improve as you learn more, that you're supposed to get better. I feel as if I know more, I should be able to play more, and I'm always trying to eliminate bad things about my playing. And it's just that feeling. I think, well, you should be able to do better, you should be able to play better, you should be able to write more. And so far, I've been lucky. That's the way it's gone.
This also brings to mind a very nice quote from Mary Lou Williams that's in one of the profiles in your new book. And she says, anything you are shows up in your music.
Yeah, isn't that a great thing?
I do like that quote a lot. It seems to me that cuts both ways, though.
probably does.
The wisdom of your life is reflected in your music. But if you're really in a real rut emotionally, that could come out in your music, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it could. I mean, I don't want to drop any names, but I can think of some people years ago that I felt that about, that they would reach a certain level. And I guess the temptation is, if you're very well known, is to reach a certain level and then coast on what you had. And you sort of think, well, I don't have to do any better. But I think maybe that's the way I've always been brought up, that you're supposed to always do your best and try hard and don't give up. And there's this saying about, I forget who said this, but that when you sit down to play, you should play as if it were the last day of your life. Play as well as you can, because it may be the last chance you have to play. And I think a lot of us do feel that way.
I thank you very much.
Are we done?
For being with us. Yeah, the time just flew by. Thank you so much for being here, Marian McPartland.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Marian McPartland recorded in 1987. Today is her 80th birthday. She celebrates with a concert tomorrow night, which will be broadcast live from Town Hall on many NPR stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Happy birthday, Marian.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Hollywood's idealized vision of the American dream was created under the reign of film moguls who were Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. We'll hear from Neil Gabler, whose book is the basis of Sunday's A&E documentary on Jews, movies, and the American dream. Also, John Powers reviews Primary Colors.
Dare to dream really do come true. So- someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. Where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops, that's where you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie moguls who built the major studios, MGM, Columbia, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Fox, and Universal, had something in common beyond movies. They were all Eastern European Jews. They're the subject of the new documentary Hollywoodism, Jews, Movies, and the American Dream, which will be shown Sunday night on A&E. It's based on the book An Empire of Their Own by film critic Neil Gabler. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Gabler, recorded when the book was published in 1988. The book opens with a paradox. The movies that created our images of America were actually made by Jewish immigrants who didn't fit into the dreams that they themselves created.
Well, the interesting thing, I think, about the individuals who created the motion picture industry, that first generation of so-called moguls, Adolf Zukor and Harry Cohn and Louis B. Mayer and the Warner Brothers and Carl Emley, was that though they are almost always characterized in history and indeed exist in our imaginations as vulgarians with gold pinky rings and a men of absolute, of no education, no culture, quite the contrary, in fact, was true in terms of their aspirations. Oddly enough, though, as I say, we characterize them as vulgarians, and though they are often regarded as the villains in the history of the movies, and by some the villains of history of in the history of American culture generally, these were men who desperately wanted, by and large, to enter those hallowed precincts of genteel American aristocracy. Most of them came to the United States and settled in the East, and they had their eyes cocked toward the Eastern aristocracy. But they were proscribed from entering those precincts because they were Jewish, because they were uneducated, because they didn't have the style that the genteel and Gentile aristocracy required.
Okay, you mentioned Louis B. Mayer. Give us just a thumbnail sketch of his Eastern European background and how he came to America.
Well, Louis B. Mayer, though he was very loath to discuss his origins, was born in Russia, came to the United States, actually came to Canada first, and settled in St. John with his father, who was a junk man. And he moved from St. John to Boston, where he really was a rather shiftless individual, had a very difficult time finding a position for himself. And almost by accident, because he'd been doing errands at a local theater, he got wind of an available theater in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And Mayer went there, rented the theater, and used that theater in Haverhill as a means of rehabilitating himself, really. He became the entrepreneur of Haverhill, Massachusetts. And from there, he moved into theatrical production and ultimately into film production.
That's a route that several of the moguls took, going from exhibition to distribution to production. Why was that such a common route?
Several reasons, Terry. I mean, one is that it required very little capital. You could set up a theater for a very small amount of money. In the case of Louis B. Mayer, I think the rental of the theater and the equipment was something like $600. Adolf Zukor, I think, spent something like $400 in outfitting his theater. So there were very few economic barriers to enter exhibition. But another reason was that I think the Jews had, this group of Jews, had a particular sensitivity to the public, a sensitivity that they could indulge and exercise an exhibition. Many of these individuals came from other professions prior to moving into the motion picture industry. For example, Adolf Zukor was a furrier. And he had a sensitivity to taste of necessity.
Zucker is the founder of Paramount.
That's right. Well, not really the founder of Paramount Pictures. A man by the name of Hodgkinson actually founded Paramount Pictures, but it was very shortly after Hodgkinson founded it that Adolf Zucker took over the company, and Adolf Zucker was responsible for making Paramount Pictures into the major film entity that it ultimately became.
You point out that some of these Eastern European Jews who started the film industry in America were able to get a foothold in the movie business because movies were viewed suspiciously by the economic establishment, by the financial establishment. Movies were seen to be something that could undermine moral values. Describe what the climate was like and why movies were seen suspiciously.
It's not only by the financial establishment, but equally by the social and moral establishments. The motion pictures, movies very early in this century, were regarded first as a novelty, as something that would last for a very short time, that no one of any real serious interest would get involved in, that should be left to individuals like Jews and Irishmen and whatever, because this was a fly-by-night business. But very shortly after the introduction of movies, in fact, by 1905, 1906, 1907, when the Nickelodeon sprung up, which was essentially storefront theaters with, you know, outfitted with chairs, the custodians of the moral order, the prevailing social order, realized that the movies were having a tremendous influence on individuals in this country, particularly working class individuals and immigrants, who were the primary audience for the first motion pictures. And when that happened, their first response was to launch a crusade against the movies and what they regard as the deleterious effects of the movies on that audience. And in fact, there was an anti-Semitic component ultimately in this crusade, because why, the question had to be asked, why would anyone or who would undermine the prevailing social order? Who would subvert traditional American values? And of course the answer was, well, immigrants, people who don't understand America. And it was a very short jump from accusing immigrants of subverting American values to accusing Jews, who at that time were exhibiting movies and ultimately would be producing and distributing movies.
But you point out that even the darkened theater was considered an environment that could breed iniquity.
You're right, Terry. In fact, we have to use our sympathetic imaginations to get back to the movie-going experience at the turn of the century and actually up through the teens. Today, the movie-going experience is something very different. But in those days, I mean, you go into a darkened theater. The audience was primarily women and children. You'd eat peanuts and fruit and whatever during the movie. It was a very democratic experience. You'd talk during the movie. Now, obviously, the movies were silent, although there was musical accompaniment. And afterwards, when you left the movie house, I describe a passage in the book from an editorial in The Nation, the editorial was titled "A Democratic Art." And afterwards, as that editorial describes, you know, individuals would discuss the movies, talk about them with great seriousness. I mean, the movies very quickly became an important part of the cultural lives of immigrants and working class individuals in this country, in a way that obviously Thomas Edison, who took credit for inventing the movies, and other Gentiles in no way could have anticipated, but in a way that the Jews, who exhibited movies and would ultimately produce movies, did anticipate. And it was their real strength in, if you want to use the term, in conquering the movie industry.
How do you think the personality traits of the individual studio owners were reflected in the studios that they built and in the kind of movies that they made? Maybe you could give us a couple of examples.
Some of these things are very subtle, and some aren't. I mean, in the case of the Warner Brothers, I think it's not very subtle. Jack Warner, who was the head of production of the studio, essentially, was a kind of rapscallion. He disavowed anything Jewish, disavowed anything European. He regarded himself as an American, born and bred. And the movies reflected a kind of urbanized underclass quality that anyone who enjoys Warner Brothers pictures would recognize instantly. Even the stars at Warner Brothers reflected Jack Warner in a way. Humphrey Bogart and Cagney and Betty Davis. These weren't the aestheticized figures that you find in the movies of Paramount or of MGM. I mean, these were battlers. These were people on the margins. So I would say that, you know, Warner Brothers movies romanticized outsiders because the Warners themselves regarded themselves as outsiders, outside the Hollywood establishment, outside the American establishment. On the other hand, Paramount Pictures, and the studio, as we mentioned, was run by Adolph Zukor. He set the agenda for that studio, had a kind of continental sheen. The great stars of Paramount, you think of Maurice Chevalier and Cary Grant, who worked there frequently. There was something very sophisticated, very Tony, about the movies of Paramount, which reflected Adolf Zukor's aspirations. There's something very European about the films of Paramount. And many of the stars and many of the directors, Ernst Lubitsch being perhaps the primary example, were European. MGM, on the other hand, had a kind of schizophrenic quality. On the one hand, there was the glamorous Grand Hotel element of MGM, best typified, I think, by Greta Garbo. On the other hand, there was that domestic side of MGM, best exemplified by Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney in the Andy Hardy pictures. And those reflected two sides of Louis B. Mayer. On the one hand, Mayer with his aspirations to opulence and to grandeur, and on the other hand, the kind of puritanical little Louis Mayer who believes so fervently in moral values. And that's reflected, as I say, in the Andy Hardy pictures.
Columbia was sometimes called Poverty Row because they operated on such skimpy budgets and underpaid or were reluctant to pay. I'm not sure which.
Both. Harry Cohn, who ran Columbia, yes, was very reluctant to pay decent salaries.
Oh, and I think one writer called it the equivalent of a police state. Describe a little bit what the atmosphere was like at Columbia in the early days and what, if anything, you think that had to say about Harry Cohn, who ran the studio.
Well, it had a lot to say about Harry Cohn. Harry Cohn, as I describe him in the book, waged a war against the world. Though he did have certain genteel aspirations, like Louis B. Mayer and Adolph Zukor and several of the others, on the other hand, Cohn saw himself as a kind of naked aggressor in a world of naked aggressors. The term I use in the book, I say, in a world of prostitutes, he wanted to be the procurer. And he ran the studio very much that way. There's a great story, and I heard this several times, about the way Harry Cohn operated. You'd come to him with a story idea or whatever, and Cohn would say no, without even listening. And if you took that no, you'd never get anything done at the studio. On the other hand, if after Cohn said no, you argued. You said, but Harry, I want to tell you something. This is why I think it'll work, and on and on and on. Cohn would almost always give in. I mean, Cohn operated the studio essentially as a test of one's mettle. And if you had that mettle, as Frank Capra, the most famous director at Columbia, did, you succeeded. And if you didn't, you could never succeed there. Cohn wanted a battle, and he believed that the best art came out of a kind of contentiousness. And he was certainly contentious. You used the term police state. I mean, he would watch his writers. The writers were arrayed around a kind of quadrangle at the old Columbia. And Cohn could look out his window into their offices and see who was typing and who wasn't. And he'd phone them if they weren't typing and say, "You're not typing." As if, you know, the job of a writer was to sit at a typewriter. Any contemplation was verboten. But that was the way that Harry Cohn operated. And, you know, though in the history of Hollywood, he's regarded as something like a pariah, the most anti-art, you know, mogul of them all. On the other hand, you look at the pictures that Columbia produced, the great pictures of Frank Capra and some of the great comedies of George Stevens, and there are some really extraordinary films there. And I think it's because, though Cohn was a difficult man for whom to work, on the other hand, he was a very, very supportive employer if you believed in yourself. He believed in you.
My guest is film critic Neil Gabler. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back to our 1988 interview with Neil Gabler about his book An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. It's the basis of the new documentary Hollywoodism, which will be shown Sunday night on A&E.
I think a lot of us know by now that Paul Muni's real name was, what, Muni Wiesenfeld?
That's correct. Wiesenfreund.
Wiesenfreund. And a lot of the actors got very anglicized or Americanized names, actors who had very ethnic names, Polish, Italian, Jewish. Did the studio heads have anything to do with that decision?
Very much so. In regard to Jewish actors particularly, there was an incredible sensitivity. The idea was that Jews should, be seen and not heard. And someone like Paul Muni is a perfect example. His life in some ways is a symbol of the way in which the Jewish actor was treated in Hollywood. He was always wrapped in someone else's ethnicity. He could never be a Jew or never play himself, in fact. And I have a story in the book from a close friend of Muni's that Muni would even answer the door in makeup. Because he had so far erased his own identity. And his tragedy is essentially, writ large, the tragedy of the other Jewish performers. Edward G. Robinson could play an Italian, but not a Jew. Ethnicity was something that was looked on askance by most of the Jewish moguls. After all, ethnicity was the very thing they were trying to escape. The very thing they were trying to establish is this idea that there is an America, this homogenized America with a set of traditional values. And although the Warner Brothers depart somewhat from that, they don't depart from the sense of America. Theirs is a slightly different version of America, but it's an America in which there is, essentially a middle-class, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant population. And that ethnics, shine shoes and perform and commit crimes as they do in the Warner Brothers movies, but they don't do a lot more than that.
Well, I wonder how much you think that is a result of the desire to assimilate on the part of the Jews who ran the industry, and how much of it was just good demographic sense, that there weren't that many Jews in America compared to, say, other ethnic groups, and if they made movies about Jews, maybe they wouldn't sell as well at the box office.
I think, Terry, it's partly both. I think, one, obviously they always had their eye on the box office. On the other hand, I think that the last thing they wanted to do is to create in the public consciousness a sense that Jews, foreigners, whatever, subversives, were running the industry. They lived in the constant fear from the time that they took over the industry to the time they left it. They lived in the constant fear that somehow it would all be taken away from them. Because, in fact, as I mentioned earlier, very early on there was a campaign with an anti-Semitic tinge that somehow the movies were subverting American values because Jews were running them. And then into the 30s, there was a Legion of Decency, which essentially was promulgating the same idea that the movies were subverting American values and had to be cleaned up. And then, of course, you have HUAC and the Blacklist and all the things that happened in the 40s, which had, as I indicate in the book, the perspective I take on that situation in the book, is that there was very definitely an anti-Semitic quality to Representative Martin Dias and others who ran that committee, and that it wasn't simply a matter of cleaning up the movies, but at least as the film executives perceived it, it was also a matter of cleaning up the executives who ran the movies and putting real Americans in those positions. So I think the idea somehow that the men who ran the movies weren't real Americans was something that terrified the Hollywood moguls, the Jewish moguls. And they did their best to portray themselves as real Americans, full-fledged aristocratic Americans. And they created their own aristocracy out in California.
But you describe how when big finance moved in and invested in the film industry, that gradually fewer and fewer Jews were represented on the board of directors of the major studios.
That's true. Wall Street money moves into the motion picture industry fairly early, as soon as they realized that it wasn't a novelty, in fact, but that it was very central to the American cultural life. And as that happens, gradually over the years and accelerated during the Depression when, contrary to popular belief, I mean, the motion pictures industry did not weather the Depression as well as, you know, one might think. Everyone thinks of, you know, Americans going to the movies throughout the Depression and laughing their cares away, and that really was not the way it happened. In fact, almost every major studio, with the exception of MGM, either was in receivership or was in very dire financial straits. So gradually and accelerated by the Depression, Wall Street money and Wall Street, you know, individuals moved into the companies and onto the boards, and as that happened, the power of the Hollywood Jews diminished. Also, they got older, and the power diminished because of that. And other economic changes took place in the industry, television and its incursions. The Justice Department won a consent decree from the motion picture industry to divorce exhibition from distribution and production, and that changed the motion picture industry. And so all of these things ultimately contributed to breaking up what I regarded as kind of monarchies. I mean, MGM, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Columbia, Universal, all of these things were monarchies in which the Jewish moguls were the monarchs. And as all of these other forces came into play over the years, by the early 1950s, the monarchies were beginning to crumble.
Neil Gabler recorded in 1988 after the publication of his book An Empire of Their Own. It's the basis of the documentary Hollywoodism, Jews, Movies, and the American Dream, which will be shown Sunday on A&E. Coming up, Hollywood and the President. John Powers reviews Primary Colors. This is Fresh Air. When the book Primary Colors about the 1992 Clinton campaign was published, the question was, who is the anonymous author? The answer was journalist Joe Klein. Now that his book has been made into a new movie, everyone wants to know how the film compares to the real White House soap opera. Primary Colors is directed by Mike Nichols and stars John Travolta and Emma Thompson. John Powers has a review.
Mike Nichols has been going around saying that his enjoyable new film, Primary Colors, is only a movie. While this is actually truer than he may think, frankly, it's not a very deep piece of work, there's something more than a little disingenuous about saying this of a film à clé about a sitting president caught in the midst of a sex scandal. The movie stars Adrian Lester as Henry Burton, a naive young black politico looking for someone to believe in. He finds him in Clinton-esque Governor Jack Stanton, played by John Travolta, the governor of an unspecified southern state who's running for president. Stanton's a man of huge appetites. He loves women and donuts equally. But he's also a man of real feeling. He genuinely loves his brainy, adoring wife, Susan, played by Emma Thompson, and he genuinely cares for people who are hurting. At first, Henry admires Stanton unreservedly and gets caught up in the peculiar glamour of campaigning, sleeping in bad hotel rooms, watching Stanton debate his rivals on a TV monitor, swapping cynical wisecracks with jaded aides. But Henry's feelings curdle once the bimbos start erupting and it becomes clear that Jack and Susan Stanton are prepared to scuttle their most cherished beliefs in order to win. And win they will, for Jack Stanton is nothing if not an inspired politician, as in this speech before a group of unemployed workers.
I'm going to do something really outrageous. I'm going to tell the truth. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking he must really be desperate to do that, but if you had to swallow enough garbage...
You can say it, we're X-rated.
me too, if you believe what you read in the paper.
Primary Colors was skillfully scripted by Elaine May and directed by her old friend and collaborator Mike Nichols, whose work here is characteristically uneven. Some scenes are filled with ill-timed jokes. Others hit right on the button. Nichols does very, very well with the vivid secondary performances. Billy Bob Thornton as a James Carville-like advisor, Larry Hagman as an anti-politician candidate with an embarrassing past, and scene-stealing Kathy Bates as the Stanton's old friend Libby Holden, an idealistic lesbian who's both their protector and their bleeding conscience. Still, as enjoyable as these characters are, audiences won't be rushing to the theaters to see them. The movie's selling point is that it's actually about the Clintons. And it's here that the movie's quite disappointing. Although Emma Thompson makes a good Susan Stanton slash Hillary, the movie doesn't give her much to do except periodically get angry at her husband's irresponsibility. The real-life Hillary would snap Susan Stanton like a wishbone. And the portrait of Jack Stanton slash Clinton is even flimsier. The plumped-up Travolta captures Clinton's rasp and southern fried charm. And watching this doppelganger seems slightly eerie. We actually hear his zipper when he's weaseling to Henry about whether he's impregnated a 17-year-old girl. But what's missing from this portrait is Clinton's intelligence. The brains that led him from Hope, Arkansas to Oxford turned him into a policy wonk and made him so brilliant at seizing the political middle. Perhaps Nichols feared that making Stanton intelligent would make him seem cold and calculating, unsympathetic. But whatever the reason, Stanton remains a pale shadow of the real Bill Clinton, who is, in his way, a far subtler actor than John Travolta. Although Primary Colors contains several funny campaign sequences, it's shot through with a speechifying melancholy about the state of our political life, where the press dredges through candidates' garbage, voters fixate on trivia like Susan Stanton's hairdo, and politicians must lie to get elected. Such a process seems designed to ensure that those who win office will be compromised, for the very process is compromised. Yet for all its apparent moral sophistication, the movie's ruefulness about all this is often distressingly naive. Nowhere is this truer than in its complete lack of interest in the major corrupting fact of our political life, the endless, desperate search for the campaign money that keeps every candidacy alive. After all, what's scary is not that an idealistic young man like Henry would be shocked at Jack Stanton's sexual peccadilloes, but that he wouldn't be shocked when his candidate goes selling himself to big contributors. The pundits keep asking whether this movie will be good or bad for President Clinton. Beats me. If I had to guess, I'd say that it won't make much difference in any direction. After all, it doesn't tell us anything we haven't learned about the president already since 1992. And besides, the whole Lewinsky affair is actually a much wilder and more engrossing story than anything in Primary Colors.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.